Welcome to B&B Financially Free, the podcast for ambitious individuals chasing financial freedom through buying short-term rental investments. We're your hosts, Chantel and Peter, and we're the founders of Good Neighbor Realty. Our brokerage has helped hundreds of people turn their active income into passive income by buying unique properties in incredible locations that are earning a ton of money. On this show, we'll bring on a diverse range of guests, from industry experts to everyday people who have achieved extraordinary results in their short-term rental investments, businesses, and personal lives. Whether you're seeking tactical advice or trying to unlock your richest life, B&B Financially Free is here to join you on the journey. Well, welcome to another episode of B&B Financially Free. I'm so excited to have Blake Daly on with us today. How are you doing, Blake?
I am doing amazing. I feel as light as a feather and excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we were just talking about how you quit your job. I had no idea that you were investing in hotels while maintaining a W-2. I just assumed that you'd quit that a long time ago. So tell us about this transition.
Yeah, I was still, I don't know the right word, stuck maybe, tied down, had the whole ball and chain of the Air Force W-2. So just left that. Officially separated on Friday. And I mean, here we are a couple of days later. I was talking to a buddy. It's funny. He's like, man, are you enjoying all this new freedom? And it's like, it's funny because I've had nothing but meetings and like, you know, packing my schedule back. It's like, I don't know what to do with all the empty time. And I'm just filling it, trying to get stuff done in the business. But it's been fun. It feels good for sure.
I love that. Well, for those who don't know you, so you started as a short-term rental investor with just a couple of units, and then you transitioned into boutique hotels. And recently you bought a pretty big hotel. So I would just love for you to tell us your story, you know, how you got into this space, like what you started with, what you're focusing on now.
Yes, my very first one was a VA loan, 0% down house hack that had a little mother-in-law unit that was it was attached but separated from the main house. So it had its own entrance. It locked off. We didn't have to see or hear the guests, and that was great. And it didn't. We went with Airbnb instead of doing like a long-term rental or something like that, because the long-term rental wasn't going to pay for the mortgage. Like, we'd still have to come out of pocket, and I was like, I think we can do enough to like get pretty close to breaking even. And we actually cash flowed and lived there for free. Plus, we're getting the BAH from the military and the house was paid for. So it was an awesome situation. I was like, man, if we had another place like this, like the main house would essentially be all cash flow minus the cleaning costs and like incremental utility costs. I was like, we got to go find some more of these. So we kind of like start with this little niche of finding main houses with guest houses. And we're getting, you know, essentially two units for the price of one, because these single family homes, a lot of real estate agents, as you know, are not that good at their job. Chantel's one of the best ones. So, but most people get these listings and they just listed by the price per square foot. So we're essentially getting those two units for the price of one, because we could split them off and we'd renovate the places, make them, the main house would be its own unit. The guest house would be its own unit. And then we'd have what's called the super listing, where it's both units combined. So in that one books, it would block off the other two smaller listings. So we had, I think four or five of those, and then a top and bottom duplex and a single family rental. So it was like 11 units. And at that point we got financially free, because the cash flow, like the net cash flow from our real estate, was more than I was making from the Air Force as an officer at the time. I was like, man, this is pretty cool. It's like my 5-year goal. We just did it in one. What do we do next? Right. And we jumped in the commercial side. I say we, like I always say we, it's like me and my wife. Like, she's like my partner in crime. She doesn't work in the business, but
she lets you do these things, which I mean, yeah. Like moving all around and having tenants in the, you know, smaller home. I've worked with a lot of couples where one party is like, I'm just not willing to do it. And it's so crazy, yeah. Because it's like looking at.
She's adapted.
Yeah.
We're still doing it. Like, this house that we're in Utah has two extra units, and they're both, one's completely detached, has their own parking area. The other has its own parking area, but it's like the basement unit. So we don't ever really hear people. We don't really see them. They go around the different units. And when we leave here, the basement unit's just going to be wrapped up into the main house to be one huge, really nice listing. And we'll keep the other one separated. So then it'll again be a super listing property. And I mean, this should add another, you know, 100,000 in gross to the portfolio just by moving out of this one and renting it out. So I'm like, babe, that's why we do it, right? We live there for free for 2 years, And because we live in it for 2 years, one day we'll sell it for, you know, tax-free as long as we like our proceeds are under the 500K. And when we move out, then we've got another cash flowing rental. So we jumped houses in Florida doing the same thing. We use our VA loan on two different houses that were main houses with guest houses. And those properties alone gross like 170 maybe, and like a 40 probably percent profit margin. So it's like, it's a great situation. So if you're looking to get into it, right, you're going to talk about boutique hotels a little bit, but my first deal wasn't a boutique hotel. Like these smaller deals were the stair steps that got me to where I'm at now. So it's a great way to start.
Now, you were kind of like casual about how you built up like five properties. What was the amount of time that you were doing this, and were you purchasing them as primary residences? Were you raising money? Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to build up your single family home portfolio?
Yeah, to the point where we got our net cash flow exceeded my W-2 income, that was 13 months. So from the time that we bought our first one with the VA loan, and in between there, I had a flip, a couple wholesales, a wholetail. So like I was always doing direct-to-seller marketing, looking for good deals, wholesaling or flipping the ones I didn't want to keep and keeping the ones that I really liked, like specifically marketing to the sellers for these main houses and guest houses or the small multifamily properties that I knew were in good areas and would be really good short-term rentals, because we just saw how much higher our cash flow was. It was like 3X in the panhandle market where we were at. So it's like, why do long-term rentals? Short-term rentals does so much better here. It was 13 months. And we had a mix of creative strategies in there. So I talked about the VA loan. We did the VA loan twice in that amount of time. We lived in the first for a year. So that way we could use the VA loan again. One of them was an off-market deal was listed for sale by owner and had two pictures that were taken at like 9 p.m. And that was just super dark and they're about to get foreclosed on. And this was 7 blocks away from the house that we lived in with the first mother-in-law unit. Remember, I was saying like, I wish we had another main house or the guest house. So this was our second one. It was 7 blocks away. So it was perfect. This one had a pool and a detached guest house with the pool in the middle of the two. That one crushes it to this day. And our other ones, we had a couple more that were off market, a couple more that were MLS. And these were a mix of, creative finance. Like we used partners for one of them. I did a hard money, to close one and then raise private money for the down payment. So it was a 90% hard money loan. And then I raised 10% for the private money. When I refinanced, I paid both the hard money and the private money back. And then I think the other one was, I actually did a BRRRR with the bank. So like I bought it with bank financing at 80%, and then I fixed it up. And I think 2 months later, I refinanced it with the same bank and got a new 80% loan and like did the BRRRR at the same bank. So that was a cool one. We're just doing a mix of creative finance, putting the pieces together, and like it all hinged on finding good deals. So that's where I really focused my time in the beginning, was the off, you know, driving for dollars, connecting with sellers, spending a lot of time in living rooms as a young kid, you know, trying to negotiate these deals with sellers, and was able to find some success with it.
I love that you did that, because that's something that most people are not willing to do. Like direct marketing to sellers is so difficult. And I'm sure that that has translated into what you're doing now in the boutique hotel space. We could spend all day talking about your single family portfolio, because I think that there's a lot there. But for the purpose of this episode, let's talk about your first hotel. Like, why did you feel that it was important for you to change from your strategy of single family homes into this commercial asset? What initially got you interested?
Yeah. So my first jump into commercial real estate wasn't boutique hotels. That was a pivot that came later. There was about this 10-month span where I was like gung-ho on multifamily apartments. And it was because I had like, I saw the benefits of going into commercial, getting the scale. Because with commercial multifamily, all your units are on one site. You have on-site management. You can raise money, syndicate the deals. Like it's so much more efficient in so many different ways. And I had all these houses all over the place and I was doing self-management, which was great because we were keeping our expenses low, but it was really taking a lot out of me still working the W-2 job. You know, it's like I could never turn off. So I wanted something that would be more efficient, that I could, you know, raise money, bring in investors, buy bigger deals and spend less time actively working in the business. And close that first apartment complex. And this was Greensboro, North Carolina at the very beginning of 2021. It was a 66 unit, I think like $5.5 million. Still on that one today with the partners that I closed that with. But this was the time that multifamily was getting really tough to buy. And thankfully I kind of pivoted out of it. I might be in the same position of some of these other operators that had these, you know, 5-year construction loans or interest only periods that are now coming due. And there's like this financial or financing crisis in the multifamily space right now. So it was, in retrospect, a good pivot. But learned the commercial side, right? I can now underwrite commercial deals. I can now raise money and bring in investors and structure the commercial deals. Knew how to underwrite them and run them and all these different things. But multifamily got really tough. And I was in the Florida panhandle while COVID, right, shut everywhere else down. It was bananas in Florida. Like, we shut down for 2 weeks and then it was open the rest of the time. The beaches were full. My Airbnbs down in the panhandle were crushing it. I was like, oh my gosh, why is everybody else saying that the country is in turmoil right now? Like, Florida's rocking and rolling.
I'm from Florida, so, and I was living in Denver at the time, and I went back to Florida and I was like, oh my gosh, it doesn't exist here. Like, what is this?
It really felt like we did not go through COVID. I mean, I didn't even have to, I was in the military and, you know, like we worked from home and honestly spent like a lot of Tuesdays and Wednesdays at the beach when we were supposed to be teleworking, which I'm sure a lot of other people did. But it was just, it was awesome. It was a great place to be. Thankful it was just the right place, the right time, I think. And we had this portfolio of Airbnbs that we were running, you know, all together. And I started to look for hotels because, you know, the hospitality asset class was hurting. So there's opportunity there. And I saw all the travel demand that we were still experiencing. So I'm like, values are down, but demand is up. There's something here. We just got to find the right deal. And pretty quickly found a little 8-unit that was the first one that kicked it all off. And I had 8 units at the time. I'm looking at this 8-unit deal. I'm like, that is not a crazy jump, right? That's very foreseeable to see how this is going to go. Of now, all the cleaners are going to one location. I got laundry on site. You know, everything is consolidated. So I get the same perks as going from all these single family homes to multifamily, from going to all the short-term rentals to a hotel. Like, the efficiency and the scale is the exact same there, which is why I love the asset class. We bought that one and saw the numbers on it. I was like, oh gosh, we got something here. And then just hit it hard in acquisitions and we bought 5 hotels in the next 13 months.
Okay, that is so cool. So let's talk about this first 8-unit hotel. What was the purchase price?
It's going to sound crazy.
Okay, I'm excited about that. And then what did you think the revenue potential was, and are you outperforming what the revenue history on that hotel was, and what did you do to make it perform higher if it is?
Yeah. We bought this for $357 we got under contract like December of 2020 and closed early
357,000.
$357,000, like the price of a house.
Come on.
That I was getting 8 units for. So I was like, I think no matter what, we'll make this work. Right. And kind of to preface this thing, if you could imagine, I don't even know how to say, like, it was bright yellow and blue, super ugly, trash stacked up, old like lawnmower equipment and bikes, and this owner operator that lived on site. It was like a real rent by the room place. And when we did like the demolition for the rehab, we found needles and crack pipes and all kinds of stuff. Like, you did not want to stay here. They used plywood for the walls instead of drywall.
No.
And just painted over it. And yeah, I mean, I didn't want to sit down on the furniture because I was like, I'm going to take something home with me. Like, it was not good. So right away, we knew it was going to be a full renovation. And that's what we did with it. But the purchase price was very appealing. I got seller financing with 10% down, which really kind of made this deal at the time. So had to put $35,000 down to get into it. And then the renovation costs. So I structured this one as basically a Big Burr deal, like a Big Burr B&B, to where I bought it with seller financing, raised private money for the down payment and the repairs, had some of my own money in it as well. And then we went through the renovation process. And when we got stabilized, all the units furnished, renting out, we refinanced it, got everybody paid back on it. So I think at the initial underwriting, I'd have to look back, but I think we expected it would do somewhere in the range of like 25K per unit. So around 200,000 in gross revenue, because these were a little bit smaller. They're a little bit further off the beach, but we're going to buy this thing right for 350 and do 200K in revenue. Not too bad. But that was what I thought at the beginning. Right now we're doing, I think in 2023, we did 240,000 or 244,000 in revenue. So that sounds great, but we ended up being like, I thought we were going to be all in at like 800,000 for the renovation. I ended up being all in for like 1.15. So like another 350,000, all the COVID delays, had a bad contractor, made every mistake in the book. You know, holding costs went up, material costs went up. I cost myself six figures on one mistake on this deal, 'cause I hired the wrong contractor that didn't know commercial, the commercial code, because he's a residential contractor. So not only did I pay him to do work, I'd fire him, had to pay another guy to rip out what he did and then redo it. And then he ran off with some money too. So great learning lesson there. But now looking back, we're doing 240,000 instead of the original expected 200, but our expenses are a lot higher. Taxes and insurance have gone up pretty substantially in Florida. This is one I've tried to sell. It's too small for me now. I wouldn't buy another 8-unit, but it was a great starter property. And I, you know, would recommend that for somebody looking to get into it. But I think insurance from the first year went from 8,000 or 8,500 to now it's 41,000 for commercial insurance in Florida, because of all the carriers leaving the market, rates going up, the hurricane exposure, like all this kind of stuff. So that one obviously just really, really hurt cash flow. It's like another, you know, 30K off of my bottom line that got ripped away, which is a lot of the cash flow. So not a great deal. I would love to sell it and do more of the ones like we'll talk about next with the new one. But that was the one that started everything. So from that perspective, I wouldn't change anything, you know, because it got me to where I am. But now I know what I would know. I want to buy it again.
Yeah, hindsight is 20/20. So after that one, and honestly, like that still seems like a good deal. Like it's maybe you are getting better deals now, but like the fact that you are grossing 240 on something that you're what all in at like 1.1 ish, even with taxes and insurance, that does seem to have like plenty of skin on the game.
I will say cash flow is pretty low. I mean, it's like about 2,000 to 3,000 per month. So anywhere from, you know, in the 25,000 to 30,000 range of cash flow, which is, I mean, you could get that from a deal you pay 500,000 to 600,000 for in Florida, buy two of those and double your cash flow, right? As compared to buying this. So not the best deal from that perspective, but it's all in that insurance. If the insurance would have stayed the same, I'd have 30,000 more of cash flow. So it's like, who would have known, right? In 2020, when I was looking at the thing, what would happen in the commercial insurance sector in Florida, like multiple hurricanes, you know, Panama City Beach got hit with a category 5, Fort Myers got hit with a category 5, like just all the exposure that Florida's had with natural disasters has tanked the real estate, but the insurance market there.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then what happened after that one? You're like, this seems like a better, more efficient way to scale, to earn higher cash flow. What were the next couple of deals that you bought?
Yeah, definitely saw the benefits from this one. Like we knew how the numbers were going to shake out pretty well on this thing. It was just a matter of getting through all those renovation issues. And we were really onto something. So we started looking for more hotels. I hosted a meetup in Panama City Beach at the time. And I was like, hey, you know, bought this hotel. If anything comes up, let me know. And it's funny because I started getting sent deals, and we bought two more that were right across from the beach in Panama City Beach, an 18 unit and a 15 unit. And then my partner at the time, I think he had a chip on his shoulder because I was bringing all the deals. He's like, I got to go find something. I was like, awesome, dude, go do it. So he found the first one in the Tahoe market, and that was a 14 unit. This is in South Lake Tahoe. And then later that year, we got a 20 unit in Tahoe as well, because now people knew what we were doing. We had, you know, proven out the track record, and that came from a connection of mine. So we just started telling people what we were looking for and started putting the focus on finding more deals like that. And we really liked having two in each market like that, that we could spread out our labor costs, which is like a huge perk of the scale of hotels, right? If we had 120 unit as compared to, you know, a 15 and a 33, right? Like our expense ratio on the single deal would be higher, but now that we've got two deals, we can spread our labor costs, we can spread our supply costs, all these different things across both properties and make the NOI look better at each property when we're raising the value of each of those properties. So the scale that you get with incremental units, like as your revenue increases, your expenses don't increase at the same pace as your portfolio grows. And we experienced the same thing in Tahoe with getting our second deal there. Then it became much easier to hire because we had more revenue now that we could build out the team. And then we had enough revenue to build out the back end of the management company of our, you know, director of operations, our revenue manager, operations manager, all of our e-concierge that do all the guest messaging. So getting up to that scale really allowed us to build the company much better. And we got there like in big chunks rather than, you know, buying 87 houses. I don't know how long that would take. We had 87 units in, you know, about a year's time.
And for these deals, like what were the entry levels? Like what does the cash flow look like? And did you continue to raise money? And did you use like things like SBA loans to purchase them?
I'll kind of like speak on the markets individually. So Panama City Beach, those each property was about $1 million. So they're like 60,000 ish per unit on the purchase, which is great when you're going to have units that make 25 or 30,000 per year, right? Which they did. So that was good. Those ones we actually used like a commercial hard money lender for. At the time, you know, lending was easy. Rates weren't as bad. So getting them in hard money and then doing the BRRRR process and then refinancing is exactly what we did. Got our money back, you know, got the money back to investors. And then in Tahoe, those were both seller financed, I think 10 and 15% down. Those were higher purchase price per unit, about 160 per unit. So one was 2.3 million, the other was 3.4 million. But those gross a lot higher per unit per year as well. So those are really good purchases at the time. Like I'd love to go buy something in Tahoe at 160 per unit right now. So that's about the entry level price that we're getting into these things and how we're financing them.
Okay, cool. And then you did the BRRRR method on all of these, or were any of them turnkey?
None of them were turnkey. They're all big renovations. I'd say one in Tahoe was more cosmetic. The other ones were larger renovations and, you know, complete new furnishing, all new FFE, decor, furniture, all that kind of stuff. So big value add processes. None of them were turnkey and had to go through the work to get them there. And then, yeah, the goal was to we did refinance the ones in Florida. And then last year when me and the partner went separate ways was before our scheduled refi for the other ones. So I don't know what happened with those. I got sold out before we got there.
That's cool. And then what advice would you give for someone who's thinking about buying a commercial asset in another state and needs to renovate it? Like now that you've learned so much from, you know, what type of contractor to use, what are some things that you look for? And is it a pain in the butt to work with the city on renovating a commercial asset?
It can be for sure, depending on the municipality. But the good thing is like when you're buying these hotels that are zoned commercial, they're zoned for nightly rental use, right? It's not like going in and trying to convert a house into an Airbnb and then you're not in the right, you know, district or in the zoning area. You don't have the right property use code, so you can't do STR, right? You're not zoned right for it. And then trying to battle the city or do a rezoning or get a, you know, variance or whatever. That regulation is set up, like the STR regulation that's hitting everywhere across the country, is set up to protect the housing market and the rental market for residential properties in those areas. And it does not apply to the commercially zoned hotels, motels, you know, with commercial zoning. So you're protected from that aspect. And then as long as you don't make the mistake that I did and hire a contractor that actually is a licensed commercial contractor, like there's a commercial license and there's a residential license. And you can look this up on like your state secretary of state website. You can ask them for their license information, their license number, and look it up. See if, you know, make sure they're actually licensed, it's active, that they don't have any marks or judgments against them. So definitely advocate doing that because that, you know, cost me six figures I talked about earlier. But I would say going into a different market is easier with commercial properties. So the only commercial properties that I bought in my market were Panama City, were the first two hotels there because one, it was like a good hospitality market. And, you know, I was there and had a good network of people that were sending me these deals. So those were easier, but I bought in Tahoe, managed the renovations from Florida, right? I mean, it's 2,000 miles away, bought in, you know, from Florida in North Carolina. On the commercial side, it's much more about your team and about the team you put in place. And also you're at this scale that managing it once it goes live is much easier because it's not a single house where you can't afford to have somebody take care of things. Like when you have a fully operating hotel, it's like a business in and of itself, and you have the revenue to hire the team and outsource yourself from doing the day-to-day management. So I'd say it's easier to buy a hotel at a distance and manage it versus a short-term rental because I've done both.
That makes sense. And then when you're underwriting a hotel, what are some things that you look for now? Like what's your buy box? How do you decide if it's a good deal?
So I love value add. And one of the easiest ways, like when you're looking online or when brokers send you deals or however you're getting leads and with hotels, you can pull your own list and drive for dollars and do what I did in the very beginning. But when you get these deals, a lot of them probably aren't going to look great. Like most of the deals you see on the MLS, like it's hard to find deals that are listed right now because they get priced up on the market. But what I like looking for is not finding the good deals, but how to make the good deals. Like where's the value add in that deal? If there's a manager's units that's not counted in the revenue count, that's an easy place to add revenue by renovating that manager's unit and turning it into a rentable unit, right? Because if you have a 20, 40, whatever unit boutique hotel, you don't need to have a front office and an on-site staff. You can turn that into a rentable unit because the systems, technology, and automation and team that you're going to have in place, you don't need to operate like the business model of the past. You're modernizing it. You're making it much more short-term rental-esque. So you can eliminate that labor cost and increase your income right there. That's an easy one. Also, I think things like for these older hotels, or just it doesn't even have to be based on the age, but they don't have as many amenities. If the rooms are big enough, and you can add kitchenettes to these hotels, you can easily earn back the price and more of adding in that kitchenette in the first year. So it costs you anywhere with, you know, the plumbing and the electrical and the sink and, you know, a little stove or stovetop. It's probably going to be about $5,000 to $6,000 per kitchenette. And you can easily earn $6,000 to $10,000 more per year on a studio unit with a kitchenette versus just a, you know, single king or double queen room. So like look for ways to add value. And then the third would be like, how can I add an extra revenue stream? Can I add, you know, vending machines? Can I add paid laundry? Like the easier things to do. I wouldn't go like full restaurant or like another business within a business. But if you can add a bar and sell alcohol and have somebody, you know, a contracted 1099 who's there Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays slinging drinks to your guests, you know, that's a great extra revenue source for you as well. So look for ways to add value and make the deal, because not every deal that comes across your desk is going to be right a good deal. You've got to be creative and find ways to make them work. And the other one is like, how can you finance it? Creative finance is so alive in boutique hotels right now. Half of my deals, half of the six have been seller finance with low down at great interest rates. So bring that up. Ask the, you know, seller what's important to them. They rather defer their taxes, keep getting income from the property. Because if you lead the conversation down that route, I think this demographic of owner is very, very likely to finance for you.
That makes sense. And actually, that kind of leads me into my next question. So it's been a long time since I have stayed at like a motel or like, you know, hotel that kind of feels like those big, like multi-unit places. Like who's staying there? Like what are the drivers that you look for? Like, do you look to be close to like a state park or a particular attraction? Like who's the avatar of guests that you're typically catering to?
Yeah, such a good question and very dependent on the market, right? The avatar of who visits Lake Tahoe versus who visits Panama City Beach is very, very different. But I think in general, I kind of like answer it wide and get narrower here, is in general, I think it's important to recognize that you're appealing to people who are going to book Airbnbs or Vrbos, like the short-term rental guest, and also the hotel guest, so somebody who would go book a Marriott or a Comfort Inn and Suites or whatever, because you're going to be listed on the same platforms that each of those are on, right? You want to get wide listing distribution, so you're going to appeal to each, and you're really kind of a hybrid in between a short-term rental in a hotel at the same time, because you have the like consistency and hopefully like the quality in of a hotel and the amenities of the hotel, right? Because you can like invest more in the amenities and the common spaces and the things that guests have, because you're spreading that cost over all the units. So you get those aspects from the hotel, and then you get the ease of booking, the appeal, you know, the automation, like you don't have to go to the front desk and you can just book online and go to your room. So you get that aspect from the Airbnb. So you're really appealing broadly to the demographics from anybody who's looking to stay, which is a good thing. Now, if you try to speak to all those people, right, of who your avatar actually is, you're going to miss the mark and not get good demand at your hotel. So you really want to understand based on your area. And like me personally, I really like destination markets that already have natural demand built in, whether it's state parks, national parks, the beach, ski town, mountain towns, hiking, mountain biking, whatever it is that draws people in. I like those destinations for that because they have high demand already. And then you just break down who's actually visiting there, who's coming to your market. Like we're in the Smokies, but we're the new hotel, but it's in Townsend, Tennessee. It's not Gatlinburg or Pigeon Forge, where, you know, it's super touristy and crowded and busy. Townsend is called the peaceful side of the Smokies. So people want to be, you know, they're coming there for the more of the natural recreation of the national park, the hiking, you know, mountain biking, horse riding, tubing the river, fishing, all these different kind of things. So it's a slower pace, but still has access. Like you're 30 minutes away from, you know, all the go-karting, the arcades, the, you know, the walk in between the canyons, all that stuff that are in Gatlinburg. So a lot of families will come to this area to have a more affordable location and go into Gatlinburg for a day, because they're going to take the kids and do the stuff in the park the rest of the time. So it's really important to understand who is coming to your area, and then build your design and your FFE package to appeal to that customer demographic. Then you want to talk to them in your marketing and, you know, your titles and your listing descriptions and all that stuff, and how, like, even to the design and the copywriting on your direct booking website. Like you want to speak to the people that are there to draw them in. So it's not a, like a one size fits all approach. It's very, you know, granular with who you're actually going to appeal to where you, then if you're talking directly to that person, they're going to come pay the rates, you're going to have higher occupancy, and you're going to have better performance at the hotel.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to really understand who you're catering to. Let's talk about your biggest and most recent project in Tennessee. So walk us through that one. Walk us through, I know that this one has more going on. Like you have, I think there's a restaurant on it, right? And you're doing weddings.
Yeah, we're working on, this will be at the end of the renovation, but we're either going to do like a sandwich or a pizza shop. And also has a wedding and event venue with a commercial kitchen where we do catering out of as well. So this is definitely not like, and it's 130 units on 10 acres, 8 buildings, right by the gates of Smoky Mountain National Park. So it's a beast. There's a lot to it, right? This is not a first deal. If I were to try to close this one as my very first hotel, I would have crashed and burned. And it's really like the accumulation of the skill set that I've built with the other 5 hotels that combined were smaller, but really operated at like the same scale, because this is 40 more units, but it's the same amount of employees, really the same operating systems and processes. So that's the good point of like, I built this whole structure and framework to operate the hotel business and our management company. And then we just copied and pasted that for the new hotel. And, you know, got up and running like the day we closed, we're renting out to guests and earning money, and made $55,000 our first week. It was amazing. Woo. So it's like having that framework in place is super important, but it's also very different because there is a wedding and event venue, right? It's another large revenue source, different operations, different processes. So for that, that's not my skill set. That's not my experience. Learning it now, and I'm getting better at it. But I hired, so in-house in the management company that works at the hotel is our wedding and event coordinator, Mary Kate, who's awesome, and her husband, who's owned catering businesses and restaurants, is the catering manager. So they're our dynamic duo that handle You know, the marketing for the events and the weddings, the bride tours, the coordination day of stuff for the events, all the cooking, and the catering. So that is, you know, another $500,000 per year revenue stream. And, you know, at a 10 cap adds $5 million to the deal, which was a big value add piece for us because commercial real estate, and then as your value goes up, or as your income goes up, so does your value, which is another perk. You're not limited by the comps like STRs are. And then, yeah, we'll have a sandwich shop as well. So like over our 10 acres right in the middle, we've got this building that we'll have F&B or like food and beverage in that location as well. So that we kind of have everything on one site. We'll have all these awesome amenities, an outdoor pavilion, a pool bar, pickleball courts, putt-putt, movie theater, projection screen, game room, fitness center. Like, it's going to be awesome. So we want to keep people on the premises as much as possible, spending more of their money there to get extra revenue outside of just the, you know, the weddings revenue and the rooms revenue. So it's really maximizing this thing as a whole business.
Cool. And then when you're looking at something, so this had how many units in it?
130.
What was the purchase price on this?
$7 million. So we got it at $53,000 per unit.
Cool. So when you're looking at, you know, $53,000 per unit, what do you expect? Is there any like revenue formula that you think that people should be aware of? Because for us, it's like, you know, when someone purchases a single family home, depending on where it is, they want to gross between 10 and 30% of the purchase price in gross top line revenue. Is there any like rules like that?
They buy a $500,000 house, they want to gross at least 100K, right? Yeah, that makes sense. It's a little different. I think my kind of rule of thumb is that you want to be you want to earn per unit somewhere in between like 2 to 5, a ratio of like 2 to 5 of what you're paying for it. So we bought it for $53,000 per unit. These units will rent for about $30,000 per unit per year. So we're at over half. So that ratio is over half or what we're going to earn for what we paid for it, which is great. So I think usually like if you're paying, you know, $200,000 for per unit on these deals, you want to be making between like 50 to 100K per year. So like what's hard is when like in these really luxury markets, when they want to sell something at 300 per unit and they gross like 40,000 per year, it's really hard to make a return on that. So I look anywhere between 2 and 4, and like once it gets 5 and above, I'm just like, there's no money to be made because that's before operating expenses and debt service right now, which is at like 7.5% to 8.5% on the commercial side. So that's what I like to see is like my rule of thumb.
Cool. And then last question on this, when you're buying something, how seriously do you look at previous revenue history, knowing that you're making all these updates? And how do you project what's possible? Like, is there, because, you know, in the short-term rental world, we have AirDNA, we have Rabbit, we have like all of these great tools. Like, what tools are available for you to look at the upside potential?
Yeah, I spend a lot less time analyzing past revenue, right? Because that's not going to be a very good indication of what I'm going to earn adding all these amenities, renovating the property, better marketing, better listing distribution. So I kind of use that as a gauge of, okay, worst case scenario, we'll still do better than this, right? But like, this is an absolute worst case scenario. So I want to see like that they're, you know, at least making money, and just kind of treat it as a baseline of like, okay, I'm probably going to do minimum 2, probably 3x of what they're doing. Could probably do 2x just by better marketing and listing distribution with minor updates. So like where I get my data to get my projections is it kind of varies based on the unit type, right? Whether you're going to use short-term rental data or hotel data or a combination of the two. And I think in all cases, you probably use a combination. But if you have studios that are larger with kitchenettes, or you have like one bedroom hotel units, which is not uncommon. Like I've bought a lot of these buildings with, you know, studios, one bedroom, two bedroom units. So if they have bigger units with kitchenettes, I'm going to look more towards the AirDNA data to see how similar sized listings are performing. Cause that's what I'm going to track closer to, because your hotel data is going to be like your single kings, double queen, standard hotel rooms. So if the units I'm buying are much more like that, I'm going to go to str.com, which is a little counterintuitive, but that's for Smith Travel Report, and that's for all the hotel data. So str.com, you can go get a trend report, or you can get CoStar reports as well. CoStar owns STR. So you can get the hotel performance data like RevPAR, ADR, occupancy, supply growth, all this stuff that's really, really important, the seasonality. And then pull that to analyze those more hotel, standard hotel units. And then if I've got a blend of units, like that's where I'm going to start to like pull my hotel data, kind of average out with my AirDNA data a little bit and really rack my units based on the quality, just like you should on AirDNA, right? You're not just going to use the market dashboard on the first page and use that data. You want to pull up the active listings in that market, sort by the revenue that they're earning, and rack your quality with the other quality units. Like, all right, mine's got a pool and a hot tub, and it's like, we'll give it a subjective 8 out of 10. So go find the other listings that have a pool and a hot tub and are a subjective 8 out of 10, because that's what you're going to track more closely to and earn. So it's doing that whole process. So it's a lot more detailed than just finding a unit, plugging the address in AirDNA and doing that last part to see what the gross annual revenue would be. And then when you get there, then you're breaking out everything on monthly, because your income and your expenses are going to fluctuate a lot more, and you have more expenses cooked in there. So that's where it gets a little fun.
That's really fun. All right. Last question of the interview. What do you think the net cash flow will be on this last purchase? So like $7 million property after paying your team and debt service, like what type of return are you expecting on something like that?
So year ones are like renovation year. So it's not going to be anything to write home about. I think we'll have like 4% cash flow in year one, because we're spending $3.3 million for the renovation and the redesign. But like once we get stabilized, we should be doing between like 4.2 to 4.5 in revenue. And then I think we're going to be operating at about a 63 to 65% expense ratio. And our NOI will be somewhere in the $1 million to 1.2 range. It'll be the 1.6 range, because 2.6. Yeah, 2.6. I got all these numbers mixed up in my head, because they grossed before 1.6, netted 6. So their NOI was like 680. Ours will be $1 million more than that. So like 1.6 just on the NOI. So we're basically at a 10 cap with $1 million more in NOI, or adding $10 million to the property. So we'll have a, you know, 7-figure net cash flow stream off of this thing, plus add $10 million in revenue.
That's crazy. That's so cool. And then obviously that directly correlates to the value of the property, which I think is a huge play in different than in the short-term rental industry, because like you said, if the revenue goes up, you're not limited by just the comps around you. Commercial
the
is really
beautiful part of commercial. I love real that.
Estate. Yeah. Being in the short-term rental space, I got to say that's like the hardest part of selling them, because you could have this thing that's just like making a killing.
Yeah. Because sellers are like, oh, I should sell on the cap rate. Like, no, it's a house. That's
yeah.
Not
still house. Still residential house.
If Zillow gets their way, it'll probably do that and they'll ruin the housing market again. But
yeah, for sure. Well, not. I think that this was so helpful. Blake, thank you so much for sharing all that you've been doing and all that you've learned in the hotel space. It definitely makes it seem attainable, but at the same time, like just like a whole new world from what we've discussed on this show. How can people get in touch with you? Yeah. Oh, and tell us about your conference that you're doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We got Boutique Hotel Con coming up. So first ever Boutique Hotel Con, hosted at my Boutique Hotel, the one we were just talking about that's in the Smoky Mountains. So by that time, like 92-90% of the renovation will be done. So it'll be a beautiful property. We're doing it in the wedding and event venue, the conference itself. Everybody's going to be staying at the hotel. That'll be included in the ticket price as well. Food will be included. And it's just an awesome setting. You're right by the gates of the national park. So, you know, you can go on hikes and stuff like that. You'll be mountain views all over the property. We've got 3 pools and hot tubs across the property. Like, it's a cool place to hang out. It'll be a smaller event, like in the 100 to 125 person, like attendee range. And the goal is to make it really intimate, really value added. And super excited about it. My first bigger conference. So a little nervous, but also super excited to make it happen. And it's going on September 13th through the 15th. And we are working on getting ticket prices live now and all the details of the conference. But if you go to boutiquehotelcon.com, you can sign up, get your email added to our wait list for when we push out the prices. Because I think they're going to go quick because it's such a small venue. But Yeah, go get on the wait list and we'll let you know.
Who is this event for? So people who are real estate investors interested in getting into the hotel space, what is the content going to be like at the conference?
Yeah, so I wanted to treat this as like kind of cover all the aspects of it. So how to find deals, how to, you know, raise capital and structure your deals, creative finance aspects, definitely the design and the renovation plans that really go into making these hotels kind of maximized. And a big part will be the operations and how to actually run the hotel deals. So I'll hit all of that and a lot more. We've got some great speakers lined up. And I think our target audience is really kind of like three big segments. It's like those who already are chasing down hotel deals, might already have, you know, a boutique hotel deal or got into the space and are looking to, you know, meet others doing it, learn how to do it better and just make more in their portfolio. A big one is the people that are like investors like you and me who started in short-term rentals and are looking to get into the commercial space and continue to grow their portfolio. I think that's going to be the natural progression of a lot of short-term rental investors is to make that leap to the commercial side of real estate investing. And then the other is just, yeah, general real estate investors that want to do something cool. They like boutique hotels for their creativity, want to come learn and network. And yeah, I think it'll be pretty fun.
Well, I can't wait for that. And what's the dates on that again?
September 13th through the 15th.
Okay, cool. And we'll make sure to add that in the show notes.
It's like by like 40 minutes outside of Knoxville, like 25 minutes from the airport. So
awesome. And then how else can people get in touch with you? Can you tell them how to find you on Instagram?
Yeah, best way would be to Instagram. So it's at Blake J Daily. You can go on there, shoot me a DM. Love connecting with new people. Love answering questions about hotels. Like I could talk about them all day. So if you got something, want to connect, hit me up on Instagram.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Blake.
All right. Thanks, Chantel.
As always, thanks so much for listening. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend who's also interested in real estate investing. And don't forget to subscribe and give us a review wherever you listen or watch your podcasts.